people. Patreon.com/don'tletstartpodcast. This is an ad for that. Check it out.
And there you have it.
Dave's just staring at me. If you go to the Patreon, you get access to our Discord, which is a 24/7 nonstop 7-Eleven chat room where people talk about music. They Might Be Giants, anything you want. Sometimes I post songs there and stuff.
I'll take your word for it.
Patreon.com/don'tletstartpodcast. Join your brethren.
Ready, Dave?
Everybody, this is Don't Let's Start, a podcast about They Might Be Giants, the only podcast about They Might Be Giants, hosted by me, Jordan Cooper, and
me, Dave Fox.
Dave Fox, my friend till the end, the bitter end, yes, as I say.
It's already bitter, baby.
And this is a
just got to get the end now.
Let's get to the end of this. This is a special episode, more special than all the other special ones.
Yeah.
Because
those are all bad.
Yeah, those are all bad. Start here.
Just kidding.
Redo. This is an episode where we talk to
Jonathan Feinberg.
Jonathan Feinberg, known to some super fans as J.D. Feinberg.
Right.
He was the drummer for They Might Be Giants in the year 1992. He accompanied them on their Apollo 18 tour.
Cut Up Snake Tour.
Don't Tread on the Cut Up Snake World Tour. And he had to learn tons of songs, and he learned all these songs from their first four albums, and he's also credited on the O Tannenbaum single, playing on that track. He was a really big deal for the band because he's one of the people who are like really responsible for figuring out with them how to be a full band with their sound.
Yeah, he was the guinea pig.
That's right.
He was the prototype for having a band.
There's one thing I want to play, though. I wanted to play a clip in the intro, which I know is unusual.
This is getting out of hand.
Yeah. This is just a perfectly sums up how awesome he is as a drummer, but he's also awesome as a human being because this interview is so fun.
Very fun.
And very, very engaging.
Top five interview. I think we've interviewed five people.
Yeah, that's right. But check out, this is some captured audience banter from one of those early live shows. This is from October 92. Oh, did you hear what the guy said?
What am I hard of hearing? He said he's one of the best drummers he's ever heard.
Yeah, that's right.
Or seen. I don't remember
it's
already.
One of those. So yeah, if you want to rewind 30 seconds, there's a little button on your podcast app. Someone in the audience goes, this guy's one of the best drummers I've ever seen.
Yes.
And when I heard that, I was like, oh my God, this is a perfect way to open this episode.
I agree.
I tried to put in without overdoing it, I tried to put in so many clips of him performing on these songs and stuff because there's so much great stuff. And also, if you want to hear a lot of that, our previous episode plays a lot of clips from this tour where he played drums and they've got the whole band there for the first time.
All right.
So we talked to him about joining They Might Be Giants and a very interesting career after They Might Be Giants, which I won't spoil, but it's a big chunk of the episode, and it's really interesting.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to keep asking questions about it. Dave, I think you've got to hit that little switch behind you there.
All right.
Flip the switch.
Here we go. Our interview with Jonathan Feinberg.
Jonathan Feinberg, drummer and other. He does other things too, is what I meant. Here we go.
It's time to introduce the band. Ladies and gentlemen, on to the back in the big, big drum.
Let's see, which of you is Jordan and which of you is Dave?
That's Jordan. I'm Dave.
Hi, Jordan. Hi, Dave.
Yeah. Our voices match how we look.
Hi. Yeah. That's true.
Do you use any of the video?
No, I hate.
Because we're ugly.
Yeah.
So why don't we start with how you got into music? How did it all begin?
Yeah.
I was born. As far as I know, I was born just kind of attuned to music, listening and making. And some of my very earliest memories are of listening to the Beatles at my grandfather's house, my mother's father's house, he had a copy of Revolver. Mm. And I remember at a basically a pre-verbal age listening to that record and begging for it. And apparently I'm told that I used to ask for the Boo Jews when I'd go to his house.
Oh, that's cute.
And so I listened to the Boo Jews at Grandpa's house. And I remember in particular, I remember listening to the song For No One, you know.
Wow. Yeah.
That was me. I did that.
I knew that it was sad, but I didn't know what it was about. And I thought that it was about American cheese because I think when he says cheese or she, like there was something about that. Anyway, that's my earliest memory.
Yeah, yeah.
See, I could easily spend the entire hour talking about this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you hearing the dinging happen when my son is texting me?
No, it's so weird.
Like he never. Okay, good. Because he never texts me. He's in college. He's in Ohio.
He's like, Dad, don't do this podcast.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, dude.
I googled them.
Yeah. You're not talking to those guys, are you?
Yeah.
Okay. So yes, and I grew up with a piano in the house and a guitar. And then when I was four, my parents gave me my first toy drum set. And
oh, wow.
So really awesome. Before I was really verbal or in any other way human, I was already making music and I just grew up playing all the instruments and loving music.
Do you have any like first bands that you were in, you know, like
sure.
when you were younger?
Boy. Yep. So from 12 until about 14, wow. I was in a band.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And it was called Because.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
We were really cool.
Yeah.
That was a cover band. That was that band started because my best friend from about first grade on was a kid who came to the United States right then. He came and joined me in first grade where I was going to school. He from Russia, and so I used to spend a lot of time with him. And his parents took ESL classes from this guy who was kind of a hustler. He just did anything he could do to make bread. And one of the things he did was he taught English as a second language. My friend Alex had borrowed a guitar from me that wasn't good for much more than shooting deer with because the action was a good inch off the off the fretboard. And he said, oh, do you play? I teach guitar. He started teaching Alex guitar and we became Because.
Right.
Wow.
Actually, so that fellow who was teaching them guitar, he actually wound up hiring me to play drums for him in a working general business band that would play like high school proms and whatnot. So I was 15 years old and I was playing shows. I played on a couple of his records around that age. And then in high school, I stumbled into the local, what would be the equivalent of Off-Broadway in New York, but in Chicago, where I grew up. And I played for a couple of shows at theaters in Chicago. So I was working and playing drums from a pretty early age.
A lot of people play multiple instruments, like, you know, that we've discovered who we interview, you know, everyone has all these like hidden talents and stuff. But I was, you know, hearing all the music on your site and all the SoundCloud stuff, I was like, oh, wow, he can like play everything. Like I was pretty impressed.
Yeah, this is kind of like the coming together of so many years of doing stuff like that. Like I've always played guitar. I've always played all these instruments. And mm-hmm. the only thing that was missing was to sing with any confidence at all. Mm-hmm. And songwriting. Like I had maybe written two or three songs in my whole life up until this past year and a half. And now mm-hmm. I've written so many songs.
Yeah, yeah.
I've just exploded. And they both came out of a sense of confidence that I had never had before. And something about being in my middle age now, I'm in my mid-50s now.
You look great.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah.
I feel pandemic-y.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel pretty burnt. I feel pretty extra crispy, but thank you. So, I don't know, yeah, everything just kind of came together for me, and now I just do everything that I know how to express as a musician, I can just now do all of it all the time, and it feels really good.
Yeah, I made like 3 albums during the pandemic so far. It's just like, yeah. Well,
yeah.
Dave records his demos with me for his
That's
future
true.
Albums.
We try to keep busy.
So what brought you into audition for They Might Be Giants? How did that happen? Yeah. The tough questions.
it's kind of like asking, you know, where did I come from? Do you begin with the creation of the universe?
Yeah.
The chain of people whom I met and started working with that led ultimately to They Might Be Giants goes something like this fellow Dan Seiden. At college, we met the very first week of school. We were both walking to jazz band auditions, and we became very close friends and bandmates. And he was actually the first really original band I was in. It was called Round Band.
Three hypocrites on TV, but that's nothing new to me. Memorized by
So from Dan, I got to know his friend from New York City, Michael Holt. After college, I played with Michael Holt in his band called Pajama Garden.
That's good. I like that one.
No, I'm sorry. The band was called Birds and Bombers.
That's good, too.
And the album was called Pajama Garden.
Okay.
Anyway, I played on that. And then in that band, I met Chris Rail. He was playing guitar. Chris Rail was the center of a very important music community in New York City. He had a label called Fang Records that included many great bands, including The Very Pleasant Neighbor, The Mommy Heads.
That's good.
Vodka. Uh-huh. There were lots of great bands on Fang. Okay, so I started playing with Church of Betty, which was one of his bands. Through Church of Betty, I think I met Brian Woodbury. And that might be a name that you know because we're getting real close to the Giants now. Mm-hmm. But Brian is the husband of Elma Meyer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Yes, I know.
It was familiar to
okay,
me.
Okay, so I started playing with Brian. And then we did the song A Whole Lot of Love at the Knitting Factory on a Led Zeppelin night. But we did it in the style of Hindi filmy music in 7/8. At that Knitting Factory night was John Linnell.
Oh, wow.
And John and Brian were friends. And in fact, on Brian's first record, I play in a song called They Told You So, which John Linnell plays accordion on. So I recorded with him long before it ever occurred to me I would get to actually be in his band.
Everything they told you, it turns out they were right. But you didn't listen to them, it turns out they were right. They said you'd never make it, well, it turns out they were right. If you'd only listen to them, they still would have been right. But you could be so happy together, you would still be together. You see, you were meant to be without meaning to be, but they had to say.
So I'm at Brian Woodbury now, and then when they decided to finally put together a band, Brian being one of their trusted friends, and them maybe because they happened to see me that night and knew that I wasn't useless, and maybe because they had heard the recording that John played on, I don't know, for whatever reason, I was one of the three people that they called to audition. And somewhere I have that tape too, but I have no idea where it is.
Oh, yeah.
Where I got the answering machine message saying, we'd like you to audition. And I remember getting home and hearing that and just like, This isn't real. This isn't actually happening. But it was.
What was your context for the band They Might Be Giants? Yeah. Were you familiar with them?
Good question.
Yeah. So when I was going to music school in Los Angeles in the year 1989 to 90, Flood was on my turntable basically the entire time. Like I would listen to Toshiko Akiyoshi, and I would listen to Charlie Parker, and I would listen to this and that. But after each of those things that I had to do for school, I would put on Flood, and I lived and breathed Flood for a year.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I was hugely into their songwriting. I knew Lincoln a little bit, but Flood was really it for me, and still to this day is like to me their masterpiece. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did know about them and I loved their music, and when I got the opportunity, I was really psyched, and boy did I prepare hard.
Yeah.
Boy did I boy did I study. They gave me a tape of 35 songs or so that, you know, this is basically our live repertoire, prepare some of these. I transcribed their stage drum parts for every single one of those songs, note for note, and practiced and learned everything note for note. I didn't make anything my own in any way. I was just like, I'm going to make this as comfortable for them as possible. And I went into that audition, and there is no way that either of the other guys, who are both like incredible drummers, probably better than me in lots of ways, but I loved their music so much and I wanted it so bad and I was so well prepared that I think I just kind of bowled them over with that.
Wow. Do you remember that audition? Like,
oh yeah, I remember it clearly. It was my first time in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. I just remember being really nervous, and I remember a moment where I felt just a moment of hope because they were surprised that I knew all of the songs they had given me, that I was prepared on all of them.
Yeah, 35 is a lot.
And I was performance prepared. I could have easily gone on stage with them in that moment, and it would have been fine.
Wow.
I think I picked up on that at least they were impressed. Whether they liked me or thought I was a good player or not, I think they were impressed with my preparation, I think.
How much time did you have to wait before finding out if you you passed or not?
That's a really good question. And honestly, I don't remember.
Yeah.
Remember that this is over 30 years ago. So it's a long, long time.
Yeah.
I just remember where I was standing and where I was living at the time that I got that message from John.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, this is your Faustian friend, John Flansburgh from the NIP Giants calling. Just wanted to call you and tell you that you got the gig as our official first drummer. So prepare yourself for a lifetime of torment.
I was living on the Upper East Side of New York on 73rd Street between 1st and 2nd. And I remember coming home, and this is back when we had telephones.
Yeah.
And every person had a telephone, and it was in your house. Mm-hmm. And then there was a machine hooked up to it with a magnetic tape, which is where, dial a song came from.
Yeah.
And I listened to that and nearly fell down. I couldn't even believe it. He called me from Europe.
Do you remember the songs you did during the audition?
It was basically their entire live repertoire from the Flood tour. From Cut Up Snake, because they were already on the Cut Up Snake tour.
Yeah.
You know, the band happened for everything after Europe, so the entire United States and Japan.
Wow, so that's a long audition. That's like, you actually did like all the, like...
It was probably 90 minutes, 2 hours that I was there.
Wow, wow.
That's really long.
Yeah.
Is it? Damn. I don't know. I've auditioned for so few things.
We've both auditioned for a few bands.
I've mostly run auditions because we're always running out of drummers in my band.
me too.
What are you guys, Steely fucking Dan?
Well, we have two separate, but it's confusing.
Yeah.
He has his own band, and he's a songwriter, and I have my own band, and I'm a songwriter. But for a while, he was my bass player when we did a lot of shows, and then... He also still does bass for me, just here, recording.
Like recording.
And he's just kind of like my go-to bass player guy.
Gotcha.
I'm around, basically.
Yeah, he lives a block from me.
But yeah, I have a punk band, Dead on a Friday, and I'm the only original member, songwriter, founded the band. But
yeah,
so gone through a couple guitarist auditions, gone through many, many drummer auditions. I think we've had 5 or 6. We usually give people like 3 to 5 songs, and I kind of feel like in the first few minutes,
like
if you're clicked into something or if the person, is just an oddball and you can't work with them.
Have you watched all the Dream Theater drummer audition?
No.
What's that?
Those are all available on YouTube. It's just amazing. All these, they got 6 guys to audition. The most unbelievably technical, prog rock that there is. So, yeah.
Wow.
It's fun to watch.
And how do you choose that? It's like, he did one extra kick too much.
As you said, they knew.
Yeah.
They knew right away. Mm. The guy who was like had the greatest energy and spirit was the most fun to work with.
That's like in the Metallica documentary, Some Kind of Monster.
The bass auditions.
That really stuck in my head.
Oh, I love that so much.
Because they all seemed really good, but... There was that one dude who just seemed so fun and
Rob Trujillo.
Yeah, very like he just seemed like this positive force,
and like a team player. And
I think back to one moment in that film all the time, which is when they're hiring him and they go, "Dude, we're gonna give you $1 million, and that's just a taste."
That scene,
I laughed so hard. I loved that so much. I think of that all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
I just love like there's just these doofus kids, and they're just so excited about $1 million. Which you should be.
That's
a lot of money, but it's just like it made everybody happy. It made them happy to give them the money, and then it made him happy to get the money, and everybody was happy. It was great.
Yeah.
Well, it's like an offering, like now you're part of us.
Yep.
But Dave's actually a big Metallica fan, but the one Metallica thing we experienced together was watching that documentary.
It's just a great music documentary, just for musician personalities and all the things that can go wrong in a band.
Yeah. So you make the audition. What's the next step? You just start, it's practicing, right? But you said you were ready, so.
yeah. We started rehearsing in Williamsburg. So I wound up later living in Williamsburg because that experience, getting to know them there and getting to know that neighborhood, this place is amazing.
Yeah.
And it was at the time. I had a 2-bedroom for $750 on the L train. Those of you who know Brooklyn, you think about that.
Every interview we've done has someone saying something like that, and it drives me crazy.
Seriously?
Yeah,
it was like 30 years
ago. I think
ago,
Kurt Hoffman's like, I lived for $100 a month, and blah, blah, blah. And like, all these people say that, and it's just like, oh, Jesus Christ.
Kurt, first of all, just a momentary digression. I love Kurt Hoffman so much.
Did you hear the interview with him we did?
Nope.
That's a great.
I'd like to. Episode. Yeah.
We were really good in
that. We were great in that.
I don't know.
He's brilliant and he's lovely. So we rehearsed. I don't remember. We didn't rehearse that long. We played one, you know, dark, unannounced show at this tiny little bar in Williamsburg. Mm-hmm. We might have done one other little nothing. We might not. And our first gig together outside of those little ones was Chicago Fest, or which by then was called Taste of Chicago, in front of, I don't know, 70,000 people.
Wow.
Glenn Tilbrook was playing with Steve Naive and Pete Thomas, and I met Pete Thomas. Oh, and what was the blues? There was like a hit blues guy, Robert Cray.
Blues Traveler.
Was there? No, not Blues Traveler. No, Robert Cray was his name. He was a Stratocaster guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those guys were on stage. That was my first gig with They Might Be Giants, was in that kind of situation, mm-hmm. playing the Frankenstein drum solo in front of my hometown, in front of like tens of, I don't know if it was 70, but it was freaking lots of people. It looked like that picture I sent you of Washington, D.C. It was that, it was that many people.
Were those some of the biggest gigs you had done up until that date?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was probably the most people I had ever played for at that time. Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. I had been on German television. I don't know if that counts.
It does to me.
But no, I'd never had any experience like that at all. Yeah, it was insane. Wow. And even the regular gigs that I played with them over the coming the months that followed that were a very, very high level of excitement and you know, energy, you know.
One more time on the drums, Mr. J.D. Feinberg, ladies and gentlemen. Ladies, he wants to hear you. On the bass, Doctor.
I remember the Naya Bingy in West Virginia, I think, where I was shaken awake. I was on the tour bus, and I was shaken awake. It's like, we're going on right now.
Oh, my God.
I remember things like that. I remember it might have been the wharf. No, I'm not going to tell you that story. Never mind.
Okay.
Almost.
We can cut stuff out, by the way.
It's profane. Anyway, so it's not that great a story, but it's we were going on stage, and I had to poop, and I said, and it was time to go on.
That's great.
I said to John Flansburgh, do I have time to poop? And I remember him putting his hand on my shoulder and saying, JD, you always have time to poop. And so I did. By the way, it was at the first rehearsal that I became JD.
Let's talk about that.
Well, somebody poked their head into the room and said, phone call John. And three of us went, like that. And in that moment, they're like, you know, we got to call you something else. So I became JD.
Now, did that end the moment you stopped playing with them? Or do you like that? Did it stick around?
I've never been called JD except in that particular context.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not a name I looked for or use.
Yeah, okay.
I'm Jonathan to everybody who knows me.
Any observations about just the personalities of John and John, their working methods or just their hanging out methods?
All I can tell you about is the John and John I knew who were 30 years ago. They're probably extremely different people now.
Yeah, yeah.
And myself 30 years ago, and I've definitely grown up a lot since then. So I was very young on that tour. I was still in my early 20s.
Wow.
And they are a generation removed from me. I don't actually know how old they are, but I think they're about 10 years older than me.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone on the tour was 10 years older than me or more, like Tony Mamone had been around. So I was a little bit of an outcast. I was not someone who people really particularly wanted to hang out with, which is one of the reasons why I love Kurt so much, is that he was really kind to me on that tour. He really treated me kindly. We played card games. Like, we actually had a copy of Hoyle's Rules of Card Games with us, and we would, in fact, sit down together, read the rules to a game, and learn how to play it and try playing it. So we played Whist and stuff. So I didn't really have friends on that tour. I was kind of lonely. John and John traveled in a separate vehicle. They were in a van and we were in a tour bus. So I did not hang out with them that much. The time I spent with them, there's nothing I could tell you about either of them that would surprise you. Their personalities in person are very much reflected in their songwriting and in the way you see them on TV. The only thing that surprised me about Linnell is that how straight he was. Like, barely even caffeine, but certainly no alcohol, no drugs, no nothing. And no, John wasn't boozing it up either. But at least, you know, we know about, he'd had some experience with drugs because he wrote about it. And, you know, he would have a drink at a restaurant, but John Linnell was completely, so that was interesting about him, I thought. They were both incredibly smart and funny. They were always perfectly nice to me.
Yeah.
It was a difficult relationship. I was so much younger than everyone. And I think I was really unfinished as a person too. And I probably would not want to hang out with 23-year-old me right now. I don't know, but that's the impression I get.
I know what you mean.
I don't want to hang out with me now.
Yeah, so. Neither do I.
Neither does Jordan.
Do you think you had like what they call imposter syndrome, or were you at least confident in the music aspect of
it? You know, I do now at work, but I did not then.
I do with everything, so
I'm having it right now.
No, like as a musician, I knew where I was at. Like I was fresh out of music school, and believe me, I could play anything fast. Right? I can't do any of that shit anymore. I don't have any chops on anything. I can't play anything with facility, but I can play everything just good enough to fool you and to do a few takes and to move things around.
Yeah.
But back then, I had no doubt whatsoever about my drumming. Yeah.
Can you talk of the one thing that you're on, the one release that you're on, and I own this vinyl.
There's two.
There's two? Oh, okay.
Yes, there's O Tannenbaum, and then there's the Live at Mountain Stage, Volume 5, Particle Man.
Particle man, doing the things a particle can. What's he like? It's not important. Particle man, is he a dot or is he a speck? When he's underwater, does he get wet? Or does the water get him instead? Nobody knows. Particle man. Triangle man hates particle man.
That was an extremely technical show to make with really razor thin change margins for like one act to the next.
Okay.
I was playing the house drum kit.
What's the story with that release? Because I'm actually not as familiar with it as a lot of others.
Mountain Stage is a beautiful radio show. It's where my wife and I saw Olu Dare and Richard Thompson, and it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And we were on it. It's just one of those public radio variety music shows. That's all.
O Tannenbaum is one of the only They Might Be Giants releases with your name on it.
The green vinyl. We recorded that at a sound check at Hollywood High.
Hollywood High.
I remember them, Kurt and John, who were the two, I mean, they could read music. So they were looking at this crumbling ancient paper copy of the German version of O Tannenbaum. And they insisted, I don't remember looking at it, whether I had my own opinion, but they're like, there doesn't seem to be a repeat here. For, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Then everyone goes da-da-da-da. But they were like, no, there's no repeat written there, so we're going to play it exactly as it's written. So we just did that phrase. If you listen to it, you'll hear it. You do that phrase once. So it's this weird, completely jarring number of bars that still makes me do. For the listeners, I'm raising my shoulders up to my ears. I can't. I don't. Anyway. We'll be right back.
Yeah, it's funny. It kind of sounds like a sound check. Like it has a has a live airy like an airy
an
feel to it. Like
they
put out an album called Venue Songs, and a lot of the songs were recorded in a sound check. And it's got the same vibe where it's like you can hear the room in a way. It's like it's something I really like, actually.
I love that idea.
And then so you played the Tonight Show with them.
Yeah.
that's always like a crazy thing. That was like the first, besides German TV, I guess, right? That was that the first time you on like, you know, national television?
I think so. Yeah. But not the last. So not, I did the Tonight Show with the Giants, and I did Letterman with Lisa Loeb later.
Yeah.
So it was very interesting to have done both of those. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you the difference. So Tonight Show, first of all, only pleasant experiences of the people working on that show, and particularly of Branford and the band, who were so nice to us.
They'll be performing July 8th at Ventura Theater in Ventura, California, and August 5th at the Beacon Theater in New York. They'll be joined now by special guest singer Sid Straw, along with Branford and the Tonight Show Brass. Please welcome They Might Be Giants.
Somewhere I have in a box the sheet music from the guitar that was Branford's copy, and he signed it for me. And they were just so nice. And the trumpet player, whose name is not coming to mind, just freaked out about us, just loved playing with us so bad that every time we came to L.A. or nearby, he would be like, hey, can I come play with you guys? You
know,
And I think he did once or twice. So that was that experience. But technically, it's a union show, and so you literally couldn't touch a microphone stand without three guys there to have their hands on it. And also I was playing inside one of those acrylic drummer boxes, which is, I had never done that before, and I didn't enjoy it much. And it didn't sound good on stage. You know, inside one of those boxes, it can't. Letterman was the best stage sound I will ever have in my life.
Really?
And I don't know, if you're anything like me, growing up, learning your instrument, playing along to records, which is a lot of how I learned how to play drums, put on headphones and play, I felt like I was playing on a record in that moment. It was sounded, the sound was just so beautiful. You could cry. It had like, I better stop. Anyway, it was amazing.
Well, you know that there's, Letterman has this, people have noticed he has like a fascination with drums and drummers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. He came over. He,
yeah.
And people have pointed out to me that he shook my hand and he didn't shake any of the other band members' hands.
Yeah. So someone made a comment. Yeah. This might be on YouTube or it might have just been like a tweet, but someone made a compilation of him going right up to the drummer and going, nice drums. What are those drums?
Yes.
And it's like,
he totally did. He said, are those your drums? He asked me like whether that was my drum kit or a rental.
Yeah.
And
he always says, are those
mine?
Your drums? Yeah. So he said that. Yeah. He says that to every drummer. It's like so strange.
It's because drums are cool.
It's such a strange question.
I love that so much.
Yeah.
I love that so much. That makes
me so
happy.
Might be why the sound was so great too. Maybe he was just like, the drummer's got to have the best.
My monitors were incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. So okay.
Anyway,
they might
be Giants.
Yeah. The Tonight Show, you did Statue Got Me High and the guitar.
And the guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah. With Sid Straw.
Yeah. Sid Straw.
Sid is a great artist and a great human being. And yeah.
I asked this to Brian Doherty as well. Are there extra nerves when it's national television? I think I asked this to Kurt also, because I'm fascinated with this idea that a million people are going to see you tonight. How do you mentally prepare for that?
And these people are not like fans of the band. It's not like at a live show where a lot of them are fans. So you're really making an impression, you know?
I don't remember being particularly nervous. Like, certainly there's a kind of nerve jazz that you get because you're doing this thing where there's a little bit of pressure. But even on the Tonight Show, it happened that, you know, applause lights. We're back. All right, we're here with They Might Be Giants. Blah, 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 blah. Here they are now with the guitar. Bang, bang, tss, tss. wait, hold it. So they stopped. And they're like, we got to do that again. Not your fault. We had a technical thing. So like, so the stakes were, aren't quite as high as you might be led to believe.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
But sure. Yeah. But for sure, you're aware that like, you don't want to fuck up. So,
yeah.
but we were really well prepared. You know, we were really well prepared. So I never felt nervous in the kind of performance anxiety way. It was more like a pleasant, energetic nervousness that we get before big shows.
Pleasant nervousness. What's that like?
Yeah.
It's good. It gives you good performances.
I want to get some of that.
So I guess the next step is that you left the band. I don't know how much you want to get into that, but I'm going to put it out there.
I'm happy to tell you from my perspective what happened. Okay. I have no idea what happened from anyone else's perspective.
Okay.
So I got back. Our last show was on the New Year's Eve between 92 and 93. It was in Philadelphia, Theater of the Living Arts.
Jonathan. From Chicago, Los Angeles, and New York City, Mr. J.D.
Yeah, okay, so we played that, and we got back, and I was talking before about how I was pretty young and inexperienced. I didn't know anything about anything.
Sure.
Certainly nothing about the music business. So I bring a ton of ignorance to the relationship that I had with the band as a business entity, right? Mm-hmm. Because I didn't deal directly with John and John for that stuff. I dealt with Jamie Kittman and his crew. And they were perfectly professional with me, but nobody ever took me aside and said, here's how things are. So what happened was, we get back. I have no idea if and when there's going to be another show or what's going on. I got a job at HBO. I got a consulting job doing computer programming for HBO.
Wow.
And then things were going very well with the band Church of Betty. We planned a tour to Germany and Austria in spring of 93, I guess. It was some spring. It was either 93 or 94, whatever it was. When I finally got a phone call from Flans, I think it was, my memory is that he said, hey, do you happen to be available on this date and this date? And I was like, I'm just going to be getting back from a tour at that time, and I don't want to blow this other gig that I've got. So I think no. What I didn't understand about that conversation is that what he was saying is, do you wish to continue to be our drummer at all? And I was saying, no, I do not. I didn't know that was the conversation that we were having, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the truth. That is why I'm not in They Might Be Giants anymore. Having said that, it's fine. It hurt at the time when I realized that I was out without really being, you know, related to in a way that you would want to. If
there was no ceremonial, like, no, you know, yeah, no, goodbye, it's your last show. But yeah,
nobody threw poop on my shoes and said, I break with thee. That's a Steve Martin line.
Oh, okay.
I break with thee. I accidentally quit the band, but it was probably the right thing to do considering, you know, all what of the growth there and crazy experiences I've had since then. I don't think, for example, that if I'd stayed with the Giants, that I would have played drums on a number one single.
Talk to you about the Lisa Loeb thing, because I discovered this while Googling you for this interview. I had no idea that was you on that song. So you're on like the number one hit song, Stay, which is just like for a lot of people a really seminal like 90s song.
Everybody knows it.
I'm sorry to correct you. It's actually Sandstorm by Darude that I played drums on.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, how did that come about? Because I listened to the song a bunch this week to just kind of get it back in my head, and it's like a time warp in a way, just the sound of it.
I had been friends with Lisa since she was a year behind me at school. Wow. And my friend Dan McKenzie, he and I kind of convinced Liz and Lisa Loeb and Liz Mitchell, to do it with a band, because they were kind of a folk-esque, not folk, they don't do folk music, but they're, you know, yeah, guitar and vocals.
Stripped down.
That sound. We were like, you guys, you should do a band, and it should be us.
Yeah.
So I played drums and he played bass. And so I've known her since then. And after music school, I came to New York, and she was one of the people I came to play with. And at the time, Chad Fisher was playing drum set for her. So I played percussion.
So I was curious, like, before this song became like this huge hit, did you have a sense?
No.
Let's say when you're just playing gigs, like, oh, this song stands out, or was it just was one of many songs?
No. I
almost never believe people when they say that, but I know that it's true. But I you hear a lot of interviews with people being like, we had no idea it was a single.
Oh, not in any way. No, how could you have known? No, yeah. We had songs I liked a lot better than that song, like when we play it live. I remember playing shows with her. So there's several parts to answer the question of how that came to be. One,
sure,
one
yeah.
is that Lisa, from the time I knew her in college, was always extremely diligent about promotion, getting the name out there, making sure people knew about the shows. She just worked really hard all the time. So that's part of the story, is that she was always mindful of those aspects of music or of entertainment that to me were like anathema. I had no interest in knowing about or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is why I was a really, really shitty band member for lots of people. Like, I didn't have any interest in touring. I just wanted to make songs that I liked. So in New York, that was still true. Like, she really hustled to get good gigs and to make sure people knew about them. And our crowd grew. And so before any of that crazy stuff happened with the number one song, we could pack some of the premier rock clubs in New York. And it was awesome. Being on the road with Lisa was when Bjork Post came out, and Liz Phair, Exile in Guyville.
Mm-hmm.
We listened to those records in the touring van and we were so devastated by both of them. Like, man, this is so incredible. How can these things exist? But as with so many things in life, it really came about because Lisa was just friends with Ethan Hawke. They lived in the same neighborhood and they knew each other through various circles. And Lisa helped Ethan with his theater company by, you know, helping him promote and do fundraisers and things. And so when he made that movie with Ben Stiller, I don't know, he had enough juice to get the song into the closing credits.
Dave, how come you're not Ethan Hawke?
Oh, I don't know. I'm sorry.
But
that in itself wouldn't have been enough. But then there was a DJ in Texas who loved the song. And
mm-hmm.
Honestly, we recorded that song in her boyfriend's bedroom.
Mm-hmm. Sexy.
I think his underwear was still on the bed. Sorry, Juan. I don't know if that's true. Juan Patino, who produced that recording, it was one of a zillion songs we recorded. There was nothing about that said hit.
Wow.
So, yeah, but boy, did it touch a lot of people.
Well, because the structure of it is strange.
It's really weird.
I never thought about it before this week, but actually it was like a YouTube comment that kind of alerted me to it, because I was reading the comments under the music video, which is like an iconic music video for the 90s.
The only thing that ever repeats in that song is the opening and closing line. That's it.
Yeah. It just keeps going and going.
Everything else is just like through written kind of poetry. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very odd, but it made me actually like the song more, you know. What's that whirlwind like when you have played drums on a number one song?
I knew it was great.
All that stuff. How did
how did
Lisa Loeb respond to that? How did you respond? How did, you know, what happens after that? Just as someone who'll never have that happen.
Yeah, never. Never.
Well, all right. So Lisa responded in the Lisa way, which is like super carefully, deliberately, there was so much pressure on her to follow up that experience with a record, with an LP. I'd have to ask her, like, she and I have done very little unpacking of that time. So we've done a little bit of the unpacking of our relationship, partly because, well, she fired me, not to put too fine a point on it. She fired me.
Okay.
And I'd be happy to talk more about that. But
well, I always love hearing firing stories because I've got many myself.
No, it's not interesting in that way. It's more like, nah, this is just not the situation that she wanted. She didn't want me and the guitarist at the time. She let us both go at the same time. There was no rancor. Not only was there no rancor, but she treated me incredibly well. She gave me a cut of the record, which I then went on to live on for 2 years and parlayed into the technical career that I have now. I went to continuing ed and got some more skills, and I ate a lot of pad thai for those couple years.
Yeah.
Which is still my favorite food.
Oh, yeah.
No, there was no rancor whatsoever. It was just her like taking care of herself and putting together the kind of people she wanted to be surrounded by. And I already alluded, like, I was pretty abrasive, I think, back then. And it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, the Giants were like, okay, well, we can get rid of this guy who's kind of a squeaky wheel.
Mm-hmm.
I had very strong feelings and opinions about music, still do.
Yeah.
But now it doesn't matter because I'm writing my own songs and I can make those decisions myself.
Yeah. So yeah. So just like to go back, like, so you have this, you're on this number one single, and like,
yeah.
When you were fired, when you left the band, I was trying to say it nicer. When you left the band, like, how long after the single happening was that? How long were you in that orbit?
Oh, well, the single happened, and then we spent a really long time preparing to make the LP.
Okay.
Tales, it's called. We did a lot of what you might call pre-production. We went to a studio in Bearsville, New York, I think.
Oh.
And had a really wonderful couple of weeks.
I think I know what the studio you're talking about.
Yeah, so we spent a long time preparing. We got a producer who really actually did change our sound.
Mm.
My own inclination with Lisa's music, and I think we all kind of fell into it naturally, was a slightly more poppy approach. And he really pulled his hair out trying to get me to literally just to open my hi-hat a little bit for certain beats and just to rock out a little bit more. And I think ultimately the band that Lisa really wanted to put together was a much more rock-oriented band, because I'm super deliberate with my drumming, and I have very kind of specific references in mind when I'm, and big open is not one of them.
Dave Grohl.
If I'm playing that kind of energy, then of course I can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just didn't feel it for Lisa's music, and she did. And, you know, God bless her. She has had an excellent career and deserves it. But to go back to the question you keep trying to ask me, it was, I just remember, okay, so yeah, we made the record, and then we did a whole bunch of stuff to promote the record. We did like MTV in Europe. Mm. We did Top of the Pops. That was awesome.
Yeah. That's where you're like miming, right?
Yes, and in fact, there you can find the videotape of us on Top of the Pops, and you can see me sarcastically playing a basically disassembled drum set, because I was so not into the whole thing that I did that, yeah.
There's like a Kurt Cobain, there's like a Nirvana thing where
Nirvana
he's just
did
like,
the same
fuck
thing.
This.
Oh, and what's funny is that Cyndi Lauper was doing Top of the Pops on the day we were there.
Oh, wow.
We were talking, so she had brought some friends to pretend to play the song, right? Not people who actually play the instruments.
Yeah, yeah.
She just had, and so the woman who was pretending to play drums for her, I don't remember how it happened, but we realized or discovered or found out from her that we had just seen her singing on stage a few weeks before at the Steely Dan show. She's one of the Steely Dan singers.
Oh, wow.
She's incredible, like an incredible musician. And we have pictures with her.
Wow, that's
that was
cool.
A very happy, weird little meeting there.
I always wondered about this with hit singles. Do you get fatigued? Do you get sick of it?
No.
Do you get sick of hearing it, playing it? No, it's just exciting, you know, because I always, when I see bands playing their hit single for so long, I'm always just like, you know, is there any sort of a feeling of like, we've got better songs, why is everyone so excited about this song? That kind of thing.
I mean, you'd really have to ask her, because I wasn't in the band that long. But I've seen her play solo a bunch of times since then. And she always kind of introduces the song by addressing that question, saying, no, the song is so meaningful to me. And the longer it goes, it takes on different meanings. And a lot of the meaning now is about the effect it has on other people. So like, she has a relationship with the song. I think James Taylor talks about Fire and Rain in a similar way, where it's like, yeah, in rehearsal, he might do it sarcastically, like this, but in the moment he's performing it, he doesn't have to summon those feelings. He's able to kind of just live the impulse that led to that song, and I totally get that.
That's interesting. Yeah, I just always think about that, because some artists go through a phase, like, you know, like when Frank Black, who he was in one of your photos, which is exciting for me. I'm like a huge fan. Like when he started his solo career, it was like no Pixie songs, like no. But then he totally went the other way and then incorporated them. And then his shows, my favorite period of his solo shows, just from like watching YouTube videos and stuff, is like where it just seamlessly incorporates the Pixie songs into his solo songs.
And I
kind of like those versions better than when the Pixies play those songs. Okay. So, the last They Might Be Giants related thing, really, the Peter Pan song. So this is, this is what I've gathered. They wrote a little song for this Peter Pan direct-to-video cartoon sequel called Now That, the song is called Now That You're One of Us.
Now that you're one of us, you think we can sing along. We are so proud of you, that you can do no wrong. We don't even care if you pull on our hair.
These are the things that lost boys.
These are the things that lost girls.
These are the things we love to do.
Yeah, so this is, I am not on this recording.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's what I thought, because I'm just like,
wow, that's awesome. No, that's not me.
To me, it sounds like an orchestra. That's why I was confused when I read about this, and I was like, I think what you're on might be the demo.
So the song I played on was almost certainly called The Island of Lost Boys.
Interesting.
I mean, that was definitely the hook.
It's a, oh, your door's opening. Yeah. Look out behind you. Oh my God, is that a dog?
Oh, I hope it's yours.
What?
Your dog.
Did he poop the door
your
open?
Dog, your door opens like in a horror movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. That's Milo.
Okay, so tell us at least the story. Maybe, I wonder if this demo is anywhere. Was it out of the blue? He calls you, emails you? What happened?
Yeah, it was not too long after we got back from the New Year's Eve show. I didn't know, you know, what was going to happen with the band anymore or whatever. So he he gave me a call. It just felt like a natural thing. Like, yeah, I'll come over. Let's do this.
Mm. Wow. Oh, this was this long ago. Wait, so what, this was like the, because this is like a newer movie.
It would have been literally in the months, you know, just a few months following our return from Philadelphia.
2002.
2002 it came out.
Okay.
Oh, that's a long...
Maybe I'm misremembering, but I don't think I ever spoke to anybody related to the Giants again, ever.
Wow.
After that phone call where I quit the band.
So, you know, because my perception was like 20 years later, they called you to do percussion for some reason on a demo, which seems so strange to me.
Do you know what? Honestly, it's possible. And for the whole time that I was living in New York, I made a lot of music with a lot of people. Like I have a drawer full of CDs downstairs of all the work that I did in that time. So, like, Flans calling me to do a thing like that would be just so kind of quotidian that I wouldn't be able to place it in my memory.
Wish I knew what quotidian meant.
Every day.
Oh,
okay.
Thank you.
You play on this demo, and that seems like it was just a quick in and out thing as far as it sounds like. Yeah. Wow.
I came into his house. I was like, oh, look, there's Dial-A-Song. I looked at the machine.
That's cool.
And he's like, yep, that's it.
Wow.
We sat there, and I remember, like, throwing a light bulb into a trash can to make it crash and recording that. Like, we had such a good time for an hour. That was the only time I ever saw either of them again after the tour, after my touring ended with them, was when I went to his house and recorded that song.
So I wanted to talk to you about your current musical project, which is on on SoundCloud and your site, and we're going to send links and stuff, because I've been listening to these songs a lot.
Oh,
and they're
awesome.
Getting in my head. They're really fun.
From the divan, I keep an eye on the sitting room. Eyes are curious in the sun. I knew the leaves while Jonathan reads in the dining room. I leave my scent on Jonathan's jeans, but he could never know.
Why don't you just explain what the concept is for our faithful listeners.
Nice.
For Dave.
Yeah, and me.
Right when the pandemic started, not too long after, it actually, I think it all started with my wife accidentally breaking my old acoustic guitar. let me rephrase that. What happened was I had left the acoustic guitar in its case on the bed, but unlatched.
Okay.
So it was your fault.
So when she perfectly reasonably picked it up by the handle, it spilled out of the case and the neck cracked.
Yeah.
And I swear to you, in that moment, I was the only thing I thought was, thank God. Because I've wanted a new acoustic guitar for years and years, sure. But you can't justify an expense like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I went out and bought that guitar and fell in love with it and just started playing it all the time. And then, like, I had dribs and drabs of audio gear around, so I made a recording, actually, of the song Dying by XTC, which I didn't share with you.
Oh, my God.
Because I feel less confident about that particular recording. But anyway, I was like, oh, that's fun. I have access to this technology that lets me make music.
Yeah.
And from there, I started doing stuff. Ultimately, I wound up doing a few covers and sharing them on Facebook.
Yeah.
No Thugs in Our House was the first one where people were like, whoa, that's really good.
That blew my mind. I listened to that just a few hours ago. It sounds exactly like the album.
Yeah.
Banging out the headache on the kitchen door. All the while, Graham slept on, dreaming of the world where he could do just what he wanted to. No thugs in our house. Are there, dear? We made that clear.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that song so many times.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, from XTC fan to XTC fan. Like, the drum sound, you've got that big English settlement drum sound. Dave's a little out of the loop here. He doesn't know XTC very much.
Yeah, I'm listening. But,
that's
interesting.
Yeah, that's the Steve Lillywhite sound. Yeah.
So that was incredible.
So yeah, that's an example of I have basically two different kinds of covers. There's the kind that are production etudes, which is what that is. It's like me how close can I get with this crappy equipment that I have? And then there's the covers where I'm actually trying to do something, that's different. So I was so enjoying the reaction I was getting and just kind of sharing things with people that I came up with this insane idea to have people request cover songs.
Yeah.
And I asked, please give me a song. And it has to be, the rules were, it has to be a song that you love. Can't be something that you love unironically. It has to be a song you really care about.
No torture.
Yeah, just nothing that's just like, ah, ha, ha, this will bust his balls. And I want some kind of constraint, which I did not give any examples of because I didn't want to poison anybody's imagination. I would say about a third of the people forgot to give me a constraint. That was fine. I just did the song. But everyone else said really interesting, fun things, like there must be some acoustic guitar on it. Well, okay, the entire thing is just acoustic guitar and voice then.
Yeah, yeah.
Stuff like that that I really had fun with. I very highly recommend, as an art-making practice, getting constraints from wherever you can get them. So anyway, that happened. It went well. It ended, and I got really depressed for like 3 months. I lost the thing that had given my life structure and meaning and energy. What, interestingly, as it was ending, I had the idea of writing songs based on request, but was terrified because I didn't write songs. I don't know. What if I get into that and I can't get out? And then all these things happened around the same time. One thing that happened was, it wasn't exactly a religious experience, but I was taking a walk and had the idea to do this project of song requests, and I suddenly felt happy for the first time in months.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh, this is exciting though. And I noticed it. And I'm like, okay, I got to do that then.
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. You know,
I've had those times.
It was really frightening, but I was like, it gives me energy. Then I have to go there. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Lisa Loeb and some people she was working with at the time came to me and said, hey, we're doing musical theater thing over the internet. That's going to be about the pandemic. Mm. You know, would you like to write a song for it? And I was like, yeah. Sure. Wow. I didn't know how, but I was like, well, writing a song for theater is easy, right? They give you the characters.
Yeah.
They give you the story that's been happening to them. They give you the scene that it's happening in, where you need to go and where you're starting. That's easy. That's like, I can do that. That's fine. And I could.
I see your unmade bed. I
see your yoga ball. I see the books you've read. I see your empty wall. I see your alienation, so out of place. I see your self-negation.
And one thing kind of led to another, and I started writing songs and became, it's never easy, it's a lot of work, but it just feels natural to me now to write songs. I still have no idea what I'm going to do when I'm going to write a song. I've spent a lot of time talking to other songwriter friends about the process, and my understanding of songwriting for me is generating garbage, just tons and tons of garbage, and then you have this other part of your brain that's kind of the song recognizer.
Yeah.
And then it goes, oh, that sounds a little bit like a song. And you go, okay, well, I'll do more of that. And it's like one of those generative adversarial networks that they have in machine learning these days where this song comes out of nowhere. It comes out garbage, just garbage, yeah. Just noise. And you filter out the noise and you find you carve away all the stuff that isn't part of the song. And there you are.
Legs?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of that. That's how I do it, because I've written a few hundred songs.
Oh my God!
This is the one thing where we're flipped around. I know what I'm talking about now, and
Yeah, sure.
It's like the only thing I have confidence in is songwriting, because it's like,
oh well, that's a very good place to be.
I can't do anything else. Yeah, no. A lot of times it's come out fully formed. Shockingly, a lot of my favorite songs of mine were the ones that came out almost in real time. Like I wrote that in 20 minutes, and it's usually become people's favorites, like when I would play live and stuff. And the ones that I've spent years writing and rewriting are the ones I just almost don't even want to think about because I just can't crack it.
That didn't even happen to me until the song Boy. I don't know if you watched that video.
I did. Yeah. That was a great song.
That one took months of agony.
Wow.
I had the initial impulse and I had the music very quickly. The idea of an ostinato.
The same, yeah.
Yeah, and all those nice chords. I just knew I wanted that there. I had that and I had a melody, and then the lyrics were the process of literally months of workshopping with friends and with my wife, and everyone being like, no, that doesn't make any sense. You're doing too much.
Yeah.
And finally, after letting it go for a long time, the thing you heard.
It was a beautiful day. The afternoon had just begun. My mind was far away. The water glinted in the sun. My boy was climbing a tree. He clambered to a dying limb. He was waving to me when it cracked and fell from under him. As I watched him fall ran to where he lay. He looked so still and small. He seemed so far away. And the boy said,
yeah, it's weird how hard lyrics can be, because you can do whatever you want.
Like, I feel like they get harder the more songs you write.
Yeah, they do.
That's totally been my experience.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know why that is. I thought, it's harder and harder and harder.
I've said that before, or a million people have said that. Why should I even bother? Yeah. Or is this trite? What am I bringing to this?
I haven't struggled too much with the, has this been said before? For me, it's more, what is that I'm trying to say?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Great Minds Think Alike, the country song.
Yeah, that one's really, really nice.
As soon as I had the concept, it's a country western song, and it's about these idiots who are in jail. And, you know, that it's just pastiche, or it's genre, and you know what to do.
Great minds think alike, but tell you our story in all of its glory. Great minds think alike. It was a wedding where I saw you from my chair, and you were standing at the bar. You were slipping the tip jar into your purse. I was eating all the caviar. I felt your eyes on me. I turned around.
When it came to Boy, like, I'm actually writing a real song about something that really means something to me.
Yeah.
What am I saying? What is this song about?
Yeah.
And there have been a few others like that, where now it's actually me. It's not genre anymore. And that's really hard.
I've had the same experiences because I've also done a lot of custom songs. And I had a website for a while. I still do, but no one goes to anymore. But called writeasongaboutme.com, where people could order a song and pay me. And I've done about like 30 of them.
Wow.
And a lot of those, some of them were very easy because, sort of like you said, like they gave me such specific. This is a song for my boyfriend. He loves Mystery Science Theater 3000, you know? So I'm like, got it. But then what I found though was that spending like a very focused few years doing those, then I went blank when I was just like, I just want to write a song for myself for, you know, for no reason. And then I was like, what do I write about? And it's that I'm only just now starting.
See, I'm a genius because I solved that problem. People told me what to write about.
Yeah. But
like that's the very hardest part of writing a song. Totally handled. All I got to do is write the music.
It is hard. So like I'm only just now, it's really like a muscle because I noticed that if I write a song, if I just force myself and I do it, the rest of the week, I get all these song ideas. They just pop in my head.
Oh, interesting.
But then if I stop, it just goes completely. I even dream, like, I dreamt a bunch of songs like a month ago, and I recorded them, and, you know.
Because
it's like my brain starts
getting,
it's like, it's almost like caffeine. Like, my brain starts getting all pumped up, like, oh, now we're going to do this song idea. Now we're going to do this. But when I go kind of like in vacation mode where I don't do it, it like dries up, and it's very hard.
Well, you should do what Mike Errico says in his new book called Music, Lyrics, and Life. He says that you should journal every day. You should write 3 pages every day, no matter what.
Yeah. Well, I tweet.
Well, that's great, because I write very, very short songs, so it's perfect. Yeah. There are some songs where it's easy. Like, I challenge you to a duet that almost gives itself to you. Like, you just find all the things having to do with a duel.
Yeah.
And go.
To focus on I Challenge You to a Duet, because the people who listen to the show will know Elma Meyer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a really funny, you know, interesting song, especially I really love when things really rev up and you're going a mile a minute with the vocals.
I know you've heard that you can sing, but this is quite a different thing. I'll wait a moment while you get a blindfold and a cigarette. I challenge you to a duet.
If my barrage of semi-quiver doesn't lead you to the very obvious conclusion that you're heading for disaster, I don't know if anything that anyone could say could possibly get through to you. You're living in a dream.
If you believe that I could be intimidated by the ravings of a silly so-and-so with air between the ears, you're a delusional. You'll never even make it to the field of battle. Look at you, you're running out of steam.
Go ask your friends just who I am.
You're not the worst I've run into.
And then prepare your diaphragm.
I've sung with tougher guys than you.
Elma and Brian have been dear, dear friends of mine for 30 years now, so she hadn't sung for a very long time, and she was a little hesitant to do it.
Yeah, I was thinking of that.
But she did it. I love her very much.
Yeah.
Her record from the very early 90s.
The Green Shade.
Yeah. Is so beautiful. It's so deep. She's a really profound musician, so I have only, like, love and respect for her.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just like, I thought it was funny because she asked me to write this song, I Challenge You to a Duet, so I thought it had to be her. It had to be her. And I also know what she's like. And like her spirit is what I wrote for her. She's not combative, but she's extremely spirited. Way back when we used to hang out, was a great swearer. Like, she could really cuss.
Yeah.
anyway, so that's all. I was thinking, it was just written out of my affection for her, and also also an attempt to impress Brian, her husband, who is a great and extremely prolific songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to do something that would amuse him.
Yeah, it's really, I think people who listen to our show will find it really interesting, because she's got the one album, and not much else to hear her vocals on.
Yeah.
So that's great. I wanted to talk to you about XTC, because you mentioned that you did audition for them, and I've got to just hear about that, because, you know, like I said, they're one of my favorite bands.
Just as I met the Giants through Brian Woodbury, I also met a fellow called Dave Yazbek, who had a great band in New York City, and then wrote the Full Monty. He wrote the music for the Full Monty. He was friends with XTC, particularly Dave Gregory.
Yeah.
So When they were thinking about making what I think turned out to be Apple Venus, he hooked me up with them, and they invited me to send them audition CDs.
Wow.
So I worked on those with Brian and with Elma. And wow. They were. I didn't really have a lot of good work to give them. Like, I didn't have a lot of super well-recorded, I had nothing that sounded like XTC that I could give them and say, look, you can hire me and you can mm-hmm. trust. But I gave them the best that I had. But we made each of them a custom CD that had a song and then had Elma saying, this disc was made especially for you, Colin Molding.
Wow.
And we'd like you to sit back now and listen to the Lower East Side sounds of Fluffer. Fluffer being one of the bands I was in.
Yeah.
So yeah, we did that individually voiceovered CD for each of them. And, you know, I worked really hard on making sure that I had printed the right one for the right person and sent them off. Mm-hmm. And what came out of it was not ever playing with them, but
yeah.
I had like an hour long phone call with Dave Gregory.
That's cool.
Which wow. was certainly a huge highlight for me, just, you know, talking to an artist. And he's one of those artists who, when you talk to him, you're not disappointed. He was so not a jerk. He was so nice. Mm-hmm. And we had a friendly argument over whether I or Andy Partridge were the better tambourine player, which I enjoyed.
And I also, the other one I really want to talk about is just Better, which is like a really just fantastic pop song.
Thank you.
I feel like you're going for a Beatles thing there, but to me, it really sounds like Andy Partridge, like, especially
I'm
his...
I'm so glad you said that.
Yeah, especially his later, the ones from the 90s, like his later demos sound like that song.
I'm glad that you said that because mm-hmm. I actually set out to write an Andy Partridge song. That was my entire intent. And if you listen to it again, you will hear a rhythm guitar part that is not arpeggios, but just, it's a through written.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was 100% me trying to write an XTC song. But the more I got into it and the more the production proceeded, it just moved away from that and it became what to me sounded like a Traveling Wilburys song. And that's really
okay, yeah, sure.
where it wound up. And I was perfectly happy to let it go there, but no one else has noticed the XTC influence there. So I'm really, really happy you said that because it was 100% my intention to write an XTC song there.
It was a late lunch. I was loading the machine. I finally finished stacking up the dishes that were clean. Glasses on the top, rack the plates below. Close the latch and the red light glowed. As I stepped away with a satisfied smile, I saw a stack of dirty dishes sitting in a pile. Another day, another dollar in soul. And since you're here, I'll tell you how I come. I heard it as a kid, and now that I am grown, better to work hard than it is to be alone.
I noticed that you had worked on something called Wordle in the past, and now there's this huge sensation called Wordle, but it's not you.
Nope.
And I actually had to triple check that because I was like,
wait, ask about that.
Is he like a tech billionaire now?
Yeah. My Wordle was a word cloud maker.
Uh-huh.
And it was big too. There was a time when you could not look at anything without there being a Wordle plastered to it.
Wow.
It actually made my whole career because I made it when I was at IBM in research there. And I think because of Wordle, there was a particular hiring manager at Google who wanted me. And without that, there's no way I would have ever gotten into Google because I have my resume is like Swiss cheese.
Sure. Oh yeah, I know what that's like.
It's full of like being on tour with bands and not doing anything in particular. Like what happened to these 6 years here? I can't explain it. So yeah, just like having made this one thing got me into Google. And since then I've been very, very happy at Google. And my career has really changed who I am and what I do. Like I'm a manager now. I never thought I was going to be a manager of anything, but I'm an engineering manager, and that seems to be something that fits me. So,
did you copyright the word Wordle? Is the question?
Nope. Yeah, you wouldn't copyright it. Talk about law. You would trademark it.
Yeah. I don't know anything about anything.
I got threatened once by somebody who I think was making greeting cards, but I got pro bono legal representation and I sicked him off. And the lawyer who helped me said something to me I will never forget. When I said, should I countersue the guy? Should I sue him? And he said, when you sue someone, when you're entering the legal system, you're dancing with a bear. and the bear always leads. So
that's great. That's great.
I took that metaphor to heart, and yeah, I don't sue anybody.
Well, that's a good, I think that's a good ending for yeah.
For this so podcast too. About music.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wanted
stay
to
stay out of trouble, kids.
I wanted to thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks.
It is my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
You hear that, Dave? It was his pleasure. He enjoyed it.
I sure did,
and
Jordan.
I felt the same way. I loved
it. Was great.
It was great. I love talking to Jonathan. And by the way, like his songwriting, if you check his SoundCloud, his songwriting is getting better and better and better.
It was really awesome hearing his drums on all those clips.
Yeah.
Crazy kick action, man.
Yeah, crazy kick action.
That's what I'd say. Yeah. I love hearing drums.
Yeah. what?
Was that too general?
I love hearing drums. Any drums, Dave, or all drums?
All drums, all the time.
All drums, all drum action, yeah. All the time. So thank you, Jonathan Feinberg, for all the drums you play and all the...
nice save, all right.
And all the laughs along the way.
Yeah.
Lately I've been ending every episode with a rhyme. I don't know if you've noticed that. It's like something just feels like that's how you end something really well.
I think it's great.
I think everyone's like final words on their deathbed should be a rhyme.
Or a horrible secret.
Or a secret, yeah, a secret that then causes a domino effect
that destroys the family.
Intrigue and drama and action and drum action. If you enjoyed this episode, you might enjoy our other episodes and, of course, our future episodes, which will be even better than this one, if that's even possible. Our email is don'tletstartpodcast@gmail.com. It's spelled like how it sounds. Do I have to spell it out for you? You know that when people say, do I have to spell it out for you? I mean that literally this time. Our Twitter, @don'tletspod. Hey, special surprise.
Whoa.
Hey.
Oh, that hurt my chest.
Special surprise.
My left arm's tingling.
Don't Let's Pod. We are, Jonathan sent me some cool backstage fun photos from his tour with They Might Be Giants.
And he sent them.
That's right. He sent them to me exclusively because I'm a nice guy.
Yeah.
If you want to support the show and all of our employees here, anchor.fm/don'tletsstart. You've got a few options there. All are good. It's really nice of everyone who does it and is still doing it. Thanks, everyone. Come back next time. We're going to talk about the next thing They Might Be Giants did. Can you figure it out?
Next.
It's a mystery. You just can Google it. But that's it.
That's it.
From all of me and all of Dave.
All of you.
Keep playing those drums and reaching for those crash cymbals.
Keep watching the skies.
Keep kicking that kick.
John Feinberg, please count it off
my
for us.
First official countdown. One, two. One, two, three.
Someday mother will die and I'll get the money. Mom leans down and says my sentiments exactly. I palindrome, I'm a snakehead eating the head on the opposite side. I palindrome, I palindrome, I.